From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. UN human rights observers are on the ground in Ukraine. Stephanie Kutrix reports.
Serious repercussions can be expected if unrest continues in Ukraine, according to the UN Secretary General. UN officials are currently in Ukraine as part of diplomatic efforts to help defuse tensions in Crimea. The spokesperson for the Secretary General, Stéphane Dujarric, has called for calm.
The international community must help the key actors to calm the situation and work towards a durable and fair political solution. A further deterioration of the situation would have serious repercussions for the people of Ukraine, the region, and the global community.
The Secretary General has also urged that the human rights of all people in Ukraine are respected. Stephanie Kutrix, United Nations.
Meanwhile, some members of the right-wing leadership of the de facto Ukrainian government have made clear what their plans are once they secure power. RT's Peter Oliver reports.
I flew into Donetsk earlier on today. I was alongside an American colleague of mine from the RT's Rutley news agency. Now, we had no problems getting in here. However, what we have heard is that there's several news organizations, several TV crews from Russia were knocked back at the border. They were denied entry into Ukraine, flying from Moscow into here into Donetsk. Well, what we have seen happening here in the city is a large demonstration that's been marching through the town. There's no demonstrators noticeably in front of the Parliament building, which is just behind me. Now, this comes after the new governor of the region, Mr. Taruta, ruled that there was no protests, no demonstrations to be allowed in front of this building. All we see right now is just a few people milling around and a large presence of some riot police guarding the front door there. However, there are people marching through the streets of Donetsk right now. We've seen pictures of those and I've seen them with my own eyes. And one of the things that those groups are wanting is they want the release of a man who's become known as basically the People's Governor. He was the guy who said that he didn't think that Mr. Taruta, who is put in place by the government in Kiev, was representing the people here in Donetsk. He put himself forward. He was then arrested. Now people are campaigning for his release right now, but it does seem that whereas he's been arrested, those that did exactly the same type of thing on Independence Square in Kiev, well, they're the ones that are trying to run for president right now. Among them, well, very far right leaning politicians, well, people self-styling themselves as politicians. I looked at just who exactly one of the most latest front runners for president is. Far right, but right on track for power.
Yes, sooner or later we are doomed to fight against Moscow Empire. The only guarantee of peaceful, civilized life for the peoples reforming their life near Russia is full liquidation of the empire.
This is Dmytro Yarosh, the leader of Right Sector, the ultra-nationalist far right-wing group, who has announced he's running for president of Ukraine. He's the subject of an international arrest warrant issued by Russia. He's charged with inciting terror attacks and extremist actions.
Ukrainians have always supported the liberation struggle of the Chechen and other Caucasian peoples. Now is the time for you to support Ukraine. As the Right Sector leader, I urge you to step up the fight. Russia is not as strong as it seems.
Despite his support of internationally recognized terrorists like Doku Umarov, following his announcement that he would throw his hat into the ring for president, it's understood he demanded from the Ukrainian Defense Ministry that they provide his guys with weapons and access to hardware, and added that he would resort to more decisive measures if the government fails to respond.
It's been clear for some weeks now that the men of violence are the people exercising the decisive influence over the government in Kiev. Only at the end of 2012, the European Parliament condemned the Svoboda Party and said that its values of racism and anti-Semitism were incompatible with the European Union's fundamental values. The present regime in Kiev has 5 members of that party, and there are 3 further members in key positions of power. So we can see that the extreme right, the nationalist right and so on, is exerting an absolutely decisive role, and Europe is simply looking the other way.
Walk around the centre of Kiev and you can't miss the red and black insignia of Right Sector. The group, who are referred to by some as neo-Nazis, are actively recruiting.
Hello, is this Right Sector? I would like to find out whether or not I can join your organisation.
If you're young and athletic, have military experience, or consider yourself an intellectual, you can definitely help us out. You can come to our office and fill out a form.
Right Sector aren't the only far-right group operating in Ukraine right now. This scene shows an armoured personnel carrier flying the flag of the Ukrainian Patriotic Army, responsible for some of the most horrific scenes of repression in the country's history. Peter Oliver, RT, Ukraine.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov condemned the rise of the overtly fascist right-wing parties, but pointed out that they've had help.
The so-called interim government of Ukraine is not self-reliant. Unfortunately, it depends on the radical nationalists that undertook an armed takeover of power. And I believe that our Western partners are well aware of what they are. They regularly go to Ukraine, and among themselves, they share extremely troubling accounts of what they see there. But, I presume for political reasons, remain silent about that in public.
Meanwhile, with a referendum in Crimea set for the coming week, Ukraine appears headed towards a variety of regional plebiscites to reshape the way the regions will function under central authority in Kiev. Some among the Russian-speaking population of eastern and southern Ukrainian regions like Donetsk, Kharkov, and Lugansk say they aim to channel the chaos towards federation instead of a descent into national antagonism and civil war. For a little background on the lives and attitudes of people in eastern Ukraine, Radio VR's David Kerens spoke with Kurt Hagman, who spent 2 years recently with the Peace Corps in Krasnodon in the southern Ukrainian region of Donetsk.
Kurt, I want to thank you for joining us, and why don't you tell us how it is you as an American from Long Island, I take it, wound up in the Lugansk region in eastern Ukraine. You arrive when exactly in Ukraine?
September 2010.
And stayed until?
November 2012.
So, a couple of years, and how is it that they appointed you to the particular location you ended up?
As far as I understand, they just kind of pick volunteers out of a hat and send them places. I'm not really familiar with the goings-on of the process of selecting volunteers and why they put them where. But I know that we were sorted into 2 groups. Half of us were learning Ukrainian to go to, presumably, the west or the center of Ukraine. And then the other half, the group I was in, they trained us in Russian, and we were sent to the east or to Crimea, to the south.
I can tell our audience that I've heard Kurt speaking in Russian. He can handle the language, so you were part of society there. I understand part of the time you're teaching English, but part of the time you're really part of society, doing your own thing, being involved in people's lives and developing your own. So you were not merely an outsider. You were part of the fabric of that society for a period of time. And it was it entirely Russian-speaking in eastern Ukraine?
In eastern Ukraine, yeah. I think there are a couple key words and phrases that you hear that are taken from Ukrainian dialect, but pretty much everyone there speaks Russian. They you know, all the newspapers are in Russian, TV's in Russian. Ukrainian is taught in schools, and there are official documents. You know, the state documents are in Ukrainian, things like that. But for the most part, in the Donbas, in eastern Ukraine, Russian really is the language of the day, and that's what you'll hear on the streets and, you know, in coffee shops and things like that.
And immediately we're finding what could be a raw nerve important to the outcome of this crisis, that Russian is the language not of choice but of everyday life. It's the language of ancestors. It's the language of education. Materials for education are in Russian language. And it becomes as a great threat to this population. Let me quote the idea that they would have to learn Ukrainian, or rather have to undertake all their education in Ukrainian language. All official contacts would be, and communications would be, in Ukrainian language. In eastern Ukraine, in Crimea, the devotion to Russian language is not simply a matter of taste, it's a matter of fact and history. And Grandmaster Shirov, whom is not known to our entire audience, but a very famous chess player from Latvia, who from a Russian family, was recently discussing this problem. He put it very poignantly. He said, this is a great threat, this notion that the Maidan Revolution would banish Russian language from official discourse. And we can understand why tensions or passions are inflamed immediately if the population foresees the possibility of not being able to use their native language. So it was quite heavy-handed for Maidan to revoke the languages law and insist on Ukrainian language only in all official settings. We don't know if that'll hold, and there will be referendums. When you were there, not only were you speaking Russian all the time, but did you sense that the influence from over the border from Russia was present? You say the newspapers were in Russian, television often, always almost in Russian language. You could get a Ukrainian station, but people wouldn't watch it. Were they watching television stations from Russia proper?
A lot of my friends did, yeah. I mean, I can't speak, obviously, for a bulk of the people, but, I mean, I knew a lot of people who watched Russian TV. I know the Russian TV, the TV that I got in my apartment was primarily Russian TV. Yeah, so I would say that there was definitely, a tendency to listen to Russian TV there. As well, I would say that as far as the Russian influence goes, most of the people in the Donbas in eastern Ukraine are ethnically Russian or have relatives across the border or, have close family and relationship ties to Russia. So I think for them, they don't necessarily make a distinction between being Ukrainian and being Russian. To them, I feel like the identity question might be a little bit more mixed, whereas in Crimea, I think you have this idea that Crimea used to be a part of Russia. It really, people argue that, Khrushchev gave Crimea to Ukraine in the 50s, and they never really felt like they're part of Ukraine. But I feel like in the Donbas, there's a different sense of identity in that a distinction really isn't made in a lot of cases between the two.
I think that harmonizes what I'm noticing from some news reports today out of Lugansk. Let me read this to you. It's from Russia Today or RT. In Lugansk, another regional center in eastern Ukraine, a 1,000-strong rally waving Russian flags and chanting Russia, Ukraine, Belarus together elected the people's governor. I'll stop it there. Notice, chanting Russia, Ukraine, Belarus together. It's not as though this population can be fairly characterized as nationalist in the sense of anti-Ukrainian, or correct me if I'm wrong, but did you find anti-Ukrainian settlement? Are people really biased, discriminatory? Do they condescend towards Ukrainians, or are they accepting of in a sort of more multinational tolerant spirit? Might be hard to generalize, but did you notice a lot of wildly anti-Ukrainian passion when you were there?
I mean, I would say that they're definitely, obviously in the given moment, there are a lot of tensions, and those tensions have always been there between East and West, given the differing ideas about what Ukraine is, what the idea of Ukraine as a nation means. But I mean, I really didn't get the sense that those tensions were that legitimate or that they ran that deep, that there was that deep, anti-Ukrainian sentiment, at least in the Donbas. I mean, I always got the sense that even though they preferred speaking Russian and obviously were culturally Russian and maybe even ethnically Russian, that they didn't really draw these defining lines between what was Ukrainian, what was Russian. And even though, they still, even today, in schools, Ukrainian is taught and Ukrainian is kind of a mandatory subject. And even though they can all speak and understand it, granted not that well, I don't think that there's any animosity towards Western Ukraine or Ukrainian state.
Right. It's not as though, and I think the press has not been able, if it were there, if there was some simmering, boiling Russian anti-Ukrainian violent passion boiling up out of eastern Ukraine, I think we would have heard a lot about it by now. I don't get the sense, and you didn't either, that that's really been on the agenda, that the resistance to the Kiev revolt, the Maidan Revolution, we'll call it that, comes from other sources, from the fact that they're anxious to ban Russian as a second official language, and that this is it was a coup, and this was a mob that was not elected, that deciding much of the fate of the country for itself. We should point out as well that many officials in eastern Ukraine have been reappointed by the authorities in Kiev, and this has enraged local populations. That's been all over the press. So there seem to be several reasons for the population to be on alert now and passions to be raised, and there may well be referendums in the very near future to determine the fate of these territories, of eastern Ukrainian regions like Donetsk, Lugansk, Kharkov, and Crimea. There may be referendums where they are asked, or asked themselves, vote to decide if they want a more autonomous structure for their regions, where they can have Russian language, for instance, and elect their own officials, not be appointed. Perhaps even they'll be asking Russia to annex those territories. I'm not familiar with whether that's going to be on those referendum ballots or not. You've spoken with a couple of people in Krasnodar, where you are. I take it that it's rather quiet, calm reigns, and it's not as though we should expect fireworks.
No, I mean, as far as I understand, since the protests started, Krasnodar and you know, the east has been relatively quiet. You know, there have been revolutions. What's the word? Like, I guess protests in Donetsk and I guess some in Kharkov, but Lugansk has had a couple of protests, but nothing too serious in comparison with what happened in Kyiv. And you know, in Krasnodar, things have been peaceful. I've talked to my friends a number of times. I'm always asking, you know, how are you? Are you safe? And I've yet to hear anything to the contrary, that everything's quiet and safe. That's what they all tell me. And I talked to my guitarist friend yesterday, and he said that they're planning a referendum, as you mentioned. But as far as he understood, the referendum isn't a question of should we join Russia. It's more of a question of should we be a federation. You know, should Ukraine be a federation? Should the East have more autonomy, more ability to, you know, govern itself, including like taxing and appointing people, and you know, lingual autonomy. I think that's an important issue as well. So I don't get the sense that there's a separatist agenda going on, more of a autonomous agenda.
We'll have more on Ukraine later in this newscast. It appears that the ruling leftist party in El Salvador will get another 5 years at the helm. With a reported 100% of the votes counted, Salvador Sanchez Serén, the candidate of the Farabundo Martí National Liberation Front, was declared the winner in the runoff election Sunday with 50.11% of the votes. The candidate of the right-wing Nationalist Republican Alliance, ARENA, Norman Quijano, a two-term mayor of San Salvador, scored 49.89%. Quijano said he did not recognize the results. According to the official tally, Sanchez Serén scored 1,494,144 votes to Quijano's 1,487,510 votes, a spread of less than 7,000. In 2009, the last presidential election in the country, the FMLN's candidate Mauricio Funes edged out ARENA's Rodrigo Avila by a vote of 51.32% to 48.68%, after which Avila conceded defeat, promising that he and his party would be, quote, a constructive opposition, closed quote. This time, foreign observers were surprised by the closeness of the vote, since Sanchez Serén was expected to hold a double-digit lead as a consequence of the popular social and economic uplift programs initiated by the FMLN in the past 5 years. Among the post-election explanations for the narrow margin, one report in Monday's New York Times, which said that, according to Hector Silva Avalos, a Salvadoran journalist and research fellow at American University, a constant barrage of media coverage of street protests in Venezuela was used by Quijano's campaign to scare workers in El Salvador away from the left. The situation on the ground in Libya remains turbulent. On Monday, a spokesperson for the Libyan government said its forces seized a tanker that had loaded crude oil at a port under the control of rebels who planned to sell it independently of the Tripoli government. The North Korea-flagged ship was being escorted to western Libya. A spokesperson for the Libyan National Oil Corporation, Mohammed El Harari, told international media, confirming earlier reports by Libyan news agencies. Libyan lawmaker Abdel Wahab Al-Qaim reportedly told Reuters, quote, the ship has been seized by government forces. There was no damage to the ship, closed quote. A rebel spokesperson had earlier denied the group had lost control of the ship. Is or was Nazario Marrero the Osama bin Laden of Mexican drug lords? Mexican authorities said Sunday that fingerprint tests had confirmed 100% that Moreno, the reported leader of the Knights Templar drug cartel, who was reportedly killed in 2010, died in an early morning shootout this past weekend. The head of criminal investigations at the Mexican Attorney General's office said that further tests would continue, but they knew this time Moreno was really dead. Killing and extortion by the Knights Templar had led to citizen uprisings during the past year, with popular militias seizing towns and villages under cartel control, challenging the authority of the Mexican state. Moreno's demise was first alleged to have occurred in December of 2010 during a gun battle with federal police. The government announced at that time that he had been killed, but that his body was not recovered. NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden made an appearance in the United States on Monday via the internet, speaking at SXSW, South by Southwest Music and Media Conference in Austin, Texas. Snowden said that the current form of public oversight of the NSA could work, but that overseers are not interested in oversight.
It's clear that intelligence agencies are going to be using the internet to collect information from all of us. Is there any way that we can make oversight more accountable and improved?
You know, that's a really interesting question. It's also a very difficult question. Oversight models, audit models, these are things that are very complex. They've got a lot of moving parts. And when you add in secrecy, when you add in public oversight, it gets complex. We've got a good starting point, and that's what we have to remember. We have an oversight model that could work. The problem is when the overseers aren't interested in oversight, when we've got Senate intelligence committees, House intelligence committees that are cheerleading for the NSA instead of holding them to account. When we have James Clapper, the director of national intelligence, in front of them, and he tells a lie that they all know is a lie because they're briefed on the program, because they got the questions, you know, a day in advance, and no one says anything, allowing all the American people to believe this is a true answer, that's an incredibly dangerous thing, and that's the biggest failure. So when I would say, how do we fix our oversight model? How do we structure an oversight model that works? The key factor is accountability. We can't have officials like James Clapper who can lie to everyone in the country, who can lie to the Congress, and face not even a criticism, not even a strongly worded letter. The same thing with courts. In the United States, we've got open courts that are supposed to decide and settle constitutional issues, to interpret and apply the law. We also have the FISA court, which is a secret rubber stamp court, but they're only supposed to approve warrant applications. These happen in secret because you don't want people to know, hey, the government wants to surveil. At the same time, a secret court shouldn't be interpreting the Constitution when only NSA's lawyers are making the case about how it should be ruled on. Those are the two primary factors that I think need to change. The other thing is we really need public advocates. We need public representatives. We need public oversight, some way for trusted public figures, sort of civil rights champions, to advocate for us and to protect the structure and make sure it's being fairly applied. We need a watchdog that watches Congress, something that can tell us, hey, these guys didn't tell you that you were just lying to. Because otherwise, how do we vote? How, if we're not informed, we can't consent to these policies, and I think that's dangerous.
A large earthquake rattled Northern California Sunday, the state's largest earthquake in nearly a decade. But, according to the U.S. Geological Survey, because the quake was centered 50 miles off the coast and occurred at a depth of 10 miles beneath the Pacific seabed, it caused no damage or injuries. By the time the waves reached the shore, they had dissipated significantly. The USGS said the north coast felt only moderate to light shaking. The quake registered 6.9 on the Richter scale. Journalist Mick Collins has been following developments in East Europe for the past 20 years in the aftermath of the breakup of the Warsaw Pact. He gave testimony in the trial of the former Serbian leader Slobodan Milosevic of Yugoslavia and has written and spoken extensively on the breakup of Yugoslavia by NATO. He sees parallels between that effort and the present situation in Ukraine.
I think if we look closely at the main concerns in Ukraine, which everyone seems to recognize, although they may not give it full importance, is that the Ukraine is a transit zone for Russian energy resources. And, you know, what I like to call the natural facts of Jesus are that all of the resources in that part of the world, all the energy resources, seem to be concentrated in Russia, and that Europe is dependent on the Russian resources and has been for a very long time. And that all this rearrangement is not having any effect on these basic natural facts that Russia has the resources and Europe needs the resources. But the way we get around these facts is linguistic, which is, you know, the way the language is the first weapon of mass distraction and illusion. Right. And so we say, for instance, I just heard on MSNBC that Ukraine at one time was 100% dependent on Russia for its natural gas. But now, recently, that dependency has shrunk to 60%. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, this is the best of my kind of addled recollection. So one would imagine that they're cutting their dependency on Russian resources. But when asked, well, where does this 40% now come from? The response was, well, it comes from Germany. But then I had to ask, well, where does Germany get its natural gas?
Right.
And, of course, it gets it from Russia.
Correct.
So what really is going on here, and this is what went on in Yugoslavia as well, is that the original kind of what after World War II privileged relationships with the Soviet Union and then Russia are being, well, negotiated is too nice a term, but they're being recontorted so that Western financial and commercial interests can take control of these transactions. And one of the things that Putin has done in Russia is that he has thrown some serious constraints on the kind of the private capital that invaded Russia with the so-called here's another linguistic crisis with the collapse of the Soviet Union, the busting of the Soviet Union. What really happened was Yeltsin, the new president of Russia, went to I think it was Belarus to a hunting lodge in Belarus and met with the presidents of Belarus and Ukraine, and they made a deal that their countries would all break from the Soviet Union and that they would privatize everything.
Right.
And so all this, you know, private capital came in. They bought up all the national resources and impoverished the local population, and the country had to resort to selling their organs in order to pay for you know, this medical care that was once, you know, free and universal, but now was quite privatized. Mm. So this conflict between the private and the public began with the wars of globalization and these attacks at governments to bring down their regulations on the free flow of capital. My friend Pierre Bourdieu said, you know, globalization is not a new economic system. It is merely the removal of restraints on the free flow of capital so that capital can go everywhere and take advantage, take, you know, grave, severe advantage of situations and resources. Back in the early 90s, when Croatia was flirting with secession from the Yugoslav Federation, Enron, the smartest guys in the room, mm-hmm. came in and, in a kind of a precursor to what they would do with Arnold Schwarzenegger in California, they backed Franjo Tuđman in his campaign for the presidency of the new free Croatian state. And in exchange for that, they got his promise that the energy markets in Croatia would be deregulated and that they would get to broker all the energy deals in that region. Richard Holbrooke set up the same situation in Bosnia and Herzegovina.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.